You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. And I'm your host, Chris Wilson. The show airs on Wednesday right after calendar at 5 o'clock, and also on Sunday at 12:30. We hope you tune into the podcast page and listen to KPTZ to hear all the music and the spoken word programs. Today, I'm very excited to be introducing Elizabeth Ann Scarborough. Now, many of you may know her because she has lived in Port Townsend and the area for 30 years. But some of you may not know of her long writing career. She began in the 80s with a series called Songs from the Seashell Archives. And today, she is still writing in a group and editing in a group called Alternative Truths. So we're going to be talking about all the books in her career, the funny ones, the sad ones, and most of all, the magical ones. Thank you for coming in today, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Chris.
So let's start with a little bit about your history. You didn't start out as a writer. What was your first career?
I was a nurse to begin with because my parents wanted me to have something to fall back on.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was growing up, you were not a game designer or a computer software programmer or anything. You were a nurse, a secretary, or a teacher.
That's correct. Oh, don't forget librarian.
Well, the librarian was kind of a posh job, you know.
Okay. An underpaid posh job.
I'd have gone for that if I could have.
Mm-hmm.
No, but my mother was a nurse, so I went into nursing. Also, it's a job where you can find a job anywhere pretty much because they always need nurses.
And pivotal in your writing career, you ended up going to Vietnam as well.
Yes, I did, in the Army. Mostly, I was motivated to join the Army because I wanted to get out of Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were very nice. I had a very good childhood and all of that. But I was always very bored by Kansas City.
Right. So where did you go?
Well, first I went to Texas, and mm-hmm. then I went to Denver, and then I ended up in Vietnam.
Uh-huh. And then you wrote afterwards, quite about a decade afterwards.
About 20 years.
Oh, 20 years afterwards. It takes a long time to process.
Yeah.
You wrote The Healer's War, which interwove the hardcore reality of being an Army nurse in Vietnam with your love of fantasy or the spiritual.
The reason it did that, the main reason it did that, was that I was already a science fiction and fantasy writer. The Healer's War was actually my eighth book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to have magic in it somewhere. And actually, the kind of magic I describe in there is pretty much part of my nursing experience. Not that I had a magical amulet or there was anything that predictable, because I don't think any kind of magic you can do predictably or it wouldn't be magic.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a time or two when I helped patients just, I think, you know, willed them to stay with me kind of thing. Not by pounding on their chest and saying, stay with me, stay with me.
Mm-hmm.
But just wanting to add my will to theirs for them to be able to last a certain amount of time or get through something.
There are many stories
about
that. Yeah. Yes. And then what took you to Alaska?
The Army again. I went up to Fairbanks and at first was at Fort Wainwright, and then I was clinic nurse at Fort Greeley for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I left the Army there.
Mm-hmm.
And from there I went to work at Gallup Indian Medical Center in Gallup, New Mexico.
Did some of these places also, were they featured in your writing and the things you learned there?
Oh, yeah. Well, when Anne McCaffrey and I wrote the Pataby books, I met her in Fairbanks when she came up to do a program in the schools there. I made sure she got all of the Alaskan experiences. Like, I woke her up in the middle of the night. Well, I didn't wake her because she was an insomniac, but the Northern Lights were out. So I said, Anne, I hate to interrupt your sleep, but they don't come out in the daytime, you know. I took her to see the Northern Lights, and then we went to see Spirit of the Wind about George Atla.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to some of my friends had a moose spaghetti dinner just them, you know, what that's what they were having for dinner. And they had a dog sled team, so she got to go dog sledding. So when we wanted to write a book together, I said, what shall we write about? She said, how about the Irish and Eskimos, dog sleds, you know? So that's what we wrote about.
Well, that's exciting that you decided to put your two lives together and write some great books together. And,
thank you.
And people know about Anne McCaffrey because she wrote The Dragons of Pern.
The Dragon Riders of Pern.
And then together you began writing books about a wonderful heroine, Macorna, and then you continued that series.
Yes.
So, and also in Fairbanks, you have another passion, your handicrafts, weaving and beading.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Well, I got into hand weaving when I was in Fairbanks. I had a little store called Howling Wolf Weavers.
Mm-hmm. Woof.
Woof. Like, you know.
Warp and weft and woof.
Warp and woof. The woof is the same thing as the weft.
Yes.
But it's a more colorful word. So I did that in Fairbanks, but then I got tired of trying to make room for my loom and my cats using my warp as a hammock. So when I got down here, I got back into beadwork. I've been doing that ever since I was a little girl.
So you've continued with that here. Is it featured in any of your short stories or books, or is there anything to do with weaving and beading?
I think almost all of them mention something or the other about it. And and cats, they're not really about them because being isolated pursuits, you know, they're not really exciting to somebody who isn't doing it. But
well, you wrote books about cats, Tales of Cats and the Bark Cats, right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about those characters. What was special about those cats?
Nine Tales of Cats is actually a collection of short stories. Over the years, Andre Norton particularly had a series of anthologies called Cat Fantastic, and I wrote for most of those. And so I had all these cat stories built up that needed republishing because they didn't win. The publishing industry kind of went crazy at one point when they were very threatened by e-books.
I remember that.
And I had all the rights to my stories, so I just republished them. Nine Tales of Cats. The best thing about the book, besides my stories, which I have to, you know, say were the best thing about it, is the cover. My friend Karen Gilmore has done or redone all of the covers from most of the covers from my books. And she used her cat, Mac, as the late Mac.
Oh.
You know, best love him, as the model. And then he borrowed the nine tails from the other cats, you know, in the neighborhood. So.
Well, it feels like you've lived nine lives with all your different writing adventures and the different...
I bore easy, you know, so...
Moving on. So let's talk about... We're talking about cats, so let's talk about Spam.
Okay.
And these are graphic novels, and they're illustrated by...
Well, there's only the one graphic novel.
Oh, okay.
This is Karen's maiden voyage into doing a graphic novel, my illustrator friend. And she's done a wonderful job on it. They are so clever. She's got such great expressions in the characters' faces. But the first book was Spam versus Vampire. And that was pretty much a full-length novel. He's got two that are long, Spam versus the Vampire and The Tour Bus of Doom, or Spam and the Zombie Apocalypso.
Yes. So Spam, where did his name come from?
Well, actually, I based him on a real cat that I met shortly after I got here, who was kind of a feral, I think. But he was a very friendly feral. He knew where to get food. He was a ginger cat and had mats all over his coat. But I noticed after that every cat that I saw and every kitten that I saw, it seemed like, was an orange ginger long hair cat. So I figured that old cat got around.
Big and Papa.
So Spam looked like all the other kittens in town, so he was, you know, Spam.
Well, I've got in front of me Spam and the Sasquatch.
Yeah.
And that is really set here in Port Townsend, otherwise known as Port Deception.
Port Deception, yes.
Right. So tell us a little bit about what Spam's adventures and where he goes in Port Townsend.
Oh, well, he goes all over the place. I've renamed some of the streets and I've rearranged the geography a little bit, but there's some prominent places. North Beach is in it. And and he uses the deer as his Baker Street irregulars. and they not only give him information because the deer are all over town, so they have a great deer grapevine. And they can also provide taxi service once in a while if he's very nice and asks nicely, which he does.
And he hangs out down there on the waterfront.
Where
does he get his food?
Well, he begs cream off the top of ice cream cones and sundaes at Elevated Ice Cream. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I first moved here, Julie had a cat named Cleo who would do that. And I always got something with cream on it, so Cleo would come and talk to me and ask for my cream. And Julie was very pleased that I had Cleo in the books. And then he goes with his vampire buddy down to CJ's, and the vampire buys him. And he's not an evil vampire. He's actually the vampire law south of the border because he's Canadian.
Okay, so we're having a lot of fun with Spam. And you've also written another book that's a Christmas story.
Yes, there's a Father Christmas, which is Spam the Cat's First Christmas. I had already rewritten A Christmas Carol as at the behest of my publisher, and I didn't want to do it because I think it's been done way too much. Mm-hmm. And the original was just wonderful. So I kind of redid all little snippets of all of the stories, like from the deer's viewpoint, what Christmas is all about. And I don't think it's particularly religious because it's not any religious viewpoint. It's what the animals think of the holiday and everybody putting out lights and decorations and such. And the deer think that what it's about is they like to watch for those deer that cross the moon on a certain night because they know that those deer are following a star that leads them to the sacred hay that is the tastiest hay in the whole world in this manger.
From the sublime to the ridiculous.
And then Spam's assistant turns out to be a raccoon who is the UPS bandit.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's fun, too. Well, you are listening to Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. This is KPTZ 91.9 FM right here in Port Townsend. We're talking to Elizabeth Ann Scarborough, who has written 38 novels, 22 solo, many short stories. She's been in anthology, science fiction. She's what we call a genre bender, but predominantly, wouldn't you say, science fiction and fantasy. Right.
Because I have to have something supernatural in them, you know.
That's right.
It's what I do.
That's what you do. Yeah. Okay, and you do it so well. I wanted to mention a couple of the other books. They're written in trilogy. And duologies and one-offs. And so there's the Godmother series.
Yes.
And that's set in...
Well, the first one's set in Seattle.
Right.
And the Godmother series, people have mistaken it for children's books, and they're not. They're fairy tale mashups, but they're really not for children. In fact, I've had indignant mothers write to me angrily because there is one of the villains is a child molester. Mm-hmm. And so they thought that's what the books were promoting. They're not. He meets a terrible end, you know. I wanted to write a domestic version of my book about war, the Healer's War. I knew a lot of social workers at the time in Fairbanks. My upstairs neighbor worked with troubled teens, and the woman next door worked with abused women. So I decided that social workers were at the battlefront for domestic war. And it had a lot of meaning, too, because I know a lot of the guys who came back from Vietnam. War was black and white, but the things that they encountered with family things, both trying to be a good family person and also things that were done to them, were just baffling to them. I think that's a lot of the thing with PTSD. It's so complicated. Mm-hmm. Because things aren't black and white. They're very, very complex, and they're dealing with people that you're not allowed to shoot, you know? So
that's right.
So I wanted to write something like that, and I think I did a really good job with The Godmother.
These kinds of issues, we wrote about them, or you wrote about them and talked about them, it seems like a generation ago, and it's still all here. It's still all with us. I mean,
so well, we're all human beings.
We're
still.
All human yeah. beings still, and we fight the same battles inside. So now I mentioned at the beginning of the show that recently you've been involved with the resistance movement through writing. Tell us about Alternative Truths and how you became involved with that project.
Well, I became involved with it just because after reading the first anthology, a few friends of mine were doing it, and I thought that sounds interesting because I think alternative truth is such a ridiculous concept. But I tell alternative truths as far as that goes. Mine at least have internal consistency because the genre demands it.
You know? That's right.
So I read the first anthology. The stories in it were just excellent. It wasn't just the political viewpoint. They were just excellent stories. Louise Marley, who lives in town, wrote one mm-hmm. called, I think, The Relic, about the wall.
Yes.
And it was, I nominated it for a Nebula. I haven't mm-hmm. told Louise that, but I did that one and about three others that have been in the anthology because they're just the best stories I've read in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Stuart Hardy wrote one in More Alternative Truths. That's about a man who has lost his job to a robot, and he hates robots, and robots are responsible for all the bad things that are happening. And then he's hitchhiking, and he gets picked up by a robot.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to talking, and the robot has all the same problems he does, except it's the newer model.
It's the newer model of problem.
And I just thought it was lovely, you know.
And so, and then there's a third edition called After the Orange. Yeah. I'm waiting yeah. to read and live after the orange.
This is Manny Fishburne is the editor on that one.
Well, these books, Alternative Truths, Brown. More Alternative Truths, they are available online through all the major retailers. You can get stories printed on demand. So
yes.
They're not necessarily available to touch, but you can find them online.
Well, you can get print on demand.
Yes.
If you're not familiar with that concept, it's really very ecological because they just print a book because somebody says, I want that book.
Oh, that's right.
And so
that's
they
right.
print the book for you.
And then send it to you.
And send it to you. And it takes a little longer and it costs a little bit more, but it's cool. And if one of these days we go back to regular publishing, everybody's going to have these treasures that nobody else has.
Mm-hmm.
These will be. They're really, really good.
So, Elizabeth, you brought along one
I brought
of
along
your
the
stories.
Story that I wrote for the second volume.
Okay. So hopefully you could read a little bit
sure.
for us now.
It's called Witchcraft.com. On the day he set forth the decree abolishing Social Security for the parasitic elderly, authorizing another $40 billion worth of tax cuts for the job creators, and allocating another $700 billion for the construction of the wall between the U.S. and Mexico, the great man jetted home to the city for a well-earned rest. What he found was an annoying surprise. A disgusting old woman huddled against the wall of the skyscraper, bearing his great family name. He held his breath before he came even with her, pretty sure she would stink. "Hey, fella, got any spare change?" "Get a job," he growled, though he couldn't imagine why anyone would want to hire her. He turned to where his guards had been, making a sweeping motion with his hands to indicate they should dispose of her. But they were nowhere in sight. They'd been there just a second ago. No matter. He'd bawl them out and fire them as soon as they returned. "I had a job, but the company closed when the owners got sent back to Mexico," the old gal whined. "Everybody's got a hard luck story," he said. "Now get off my property or I'll send you to Guantanamo. You won't like it." "Watch who you're bullying, troll boy," she said. "All I want is a square meal. You think begging is easy? Easier than working for a living. How would you know? Because I have done great things with my life, wonderful things, and you are nothing but a pathetic loser who is probably going to leave a stain on my marble facade. Maybe I lost fair and square, whereas you have won using lies and trickery." "Industry standard business practice," he said. "If you'd done yourself up, maybe got a nose job, a boob job, a little makeup back when you were young, you might have even been able to date someone like me, even had a little arrangement, and not be on the streets now. Do you seriously want me to throw up on your nice clean building, big shot? Somebody get this old bat out of here," he cried to his currently invisible security team. "Oh, I'm leaving, but I will leave you with something to remember me by," she said, and vanished, poof, just like that. He was surprised to see she did it with a certain amount of class and gold glitter. Then he realized he had just imagined it, though he was not a particularly imaginative man unless it involved ways to add to his personal treasury by relocating someone else's assets. Where Glitter and Grime had met on the side of the building, two of his security guys now stood, looking professionally concerned. "Come on," the great man said, for he had no time to waste with useless poor people. He was too preoccupied to notice when something solid escaped from his lips, but the security guard protecting his rear stomped on a large hairy spider scampering toward the nearest drain.
So that was a little bit from Elizabeth Ann Scarborough reading from her story called
Wishcraft.com.
Wishcraft.com. And you know who that great man was, but we don't make political commentary on
this show.
But that was really fun, that beginning. So that maybe that would encourage you to find out about more alternative truths and our great writers that are writing for the resistance. So, Elizabeth, your characters go many different places in this world. How do you find out about where to put them and what are your inspirations?
Oh, that's the fun part, because that's where I get to do the research. Like in the Godmother series, the first one set in Seattle, I went over to one of the social services places in Seattle with a social worker friend of mine. Just got to know the city through writing the book. The second one set in Ireland among the traveling people and with Irish myths and folk tales and such. And then the third one is set in a place that's pretty close to my heart, which is in the Southwest. And this one is in the Hopi partitioned lands, which is a big issue among the Navajo and the Hopi and the government.
Is that in the Four Corners area?
No, it's really on the Hopi Rez. Mm-hmm. The Navajos had been living there for some time. So eventually the government chopped off a piece of the Hopi reservation and made it for the Navajos. Mm-hmm. And it's been contested. It's a big political football, but it's caused a lot of dissension between the two tribes. So it made an interesting conflict point to start with. And I found out a lot, read a lot about that area and stayed with the Navajo family for a couple of weeks down there and then had a Hopi informant who was the veterans counselor, actually, for the whole area, the whole Southwest area. And I met him through my friend in Fairbanks, mm-hmm. John Swan, who is the veterans counselor up there.
All of these fantasies and science fiction books really have some in-depth
A lot of research and reality.
Yeah. Okay. So that's, you know, what all writers do. You know.
Yes. Another one I did a lot of research on was The Drastic Dragon of Draco, Texas, which is, and also the sequel to that was The Gold Camp Vampire. And there, all I had to do was cross the street to the University of Alaska, in Fairbanks Library, and in the archives, they had all of these letters written back and forth between pioneers during the gold rush, mm-hmm. and they were fascinating. I kind of almost fell in love with this one guy. I realized had been dead for a long time, and if he was alive, he was old enough to be my grandfather, but he was trying to smuggle this one dance hall girl out of Dawson because there was a guy that was trying to hurt her. And it was very exciting, you know, just reading these letters back and forth.
Yeah, the letters to the editor in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner have been actually the source of a wonderful play. And they are really fun to read. Fairbanks, the Southwest, you've written about magic in the Himalayas or the Himalayas.
Yes, that came from a dream. Mm-hmm. While I was researching the Healers War, I watched the Hanoi Hilton. And that night, I had a dream that was actually most of the plot of Nothing Sacred. And it was sort of a combination of images that I had retained somehow or other from Lost Horizons, mm-hmm. and some of the prisoner of war stuff that came out in Hanoi Hilton. It just stuck with me. I pitched it the next day to my editor and said, right. You know, I've got this story. Well, let me tell you, trying to do a story from a dream, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done besides just the idea is only the beginning.
That's right. Yeah. It's been lovely talking to you today again. Thank you so much for coming in. We can't leave talking about science fiction and fantasy without bringing up the wonderful Ursula K. Le Guin.
Oh, yeah.
And who has recently left this sphere.
At 88.
Yes. And let's talk about one of her important books,
The Left Hand of Darkness.
The Left Hand of Darkness.
Which is, a lot of people know her from the Earthsea trilogy, which is the more quest type story. But Left Hand of Darkness is a science fiction book. And when I'm teaching, I always recommend it as one of the best science fiction books ever. A lot of the things, like with the Me Too movement that's so popular now, and a couple of the books that I've read about with a feminist world in them, men are the bad guys, and they're demonized pretty much. Left Hand of Darkness, though, is about someone who goes to a planet where the people are both sexes serially. They have their life cycle includes a period when they can be mothers and a period where they can be fathers. In that way, she and they understand what each sex goes through, and nobody is superior to anybody else or discriminates against anybody else because everybody's had the same experience. And I think that's brilliant. That's one of the best ways to try to understand each other.
Once again, a book written decades ago becomes so important again today to help us understand one another. We're going to be listening to some music, and the CD that we have here is called The Master Harper of Pern, and it's taken from some words of Elizabeth's friend, Anne McCaffrey, and the music is provided by Tanya Oplin and Mike Freeman, who have made appearances and will be making appearances in our very own Port Townsend. So we'll look forward to hearing their music. And thank you so much for joining us today, Elizabeth. You've been listening to Book Lovers Cafe. Join me next time when we talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and you can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website at kptz.org. Make a donation to the station as well. Thank you, Mike Schlexer, for helping with this program and so many others. And thank you to all the volunteers and our supporters, because we wouldn't be here without you, the individual supporters and our underwriters, who make this station possible. The music you heard today was Robinson's Dream from The Master Harper of Pern by Tanya Oplin and Mike Freeman.